Hey, welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us. We're going to have a really, really good show today, as Ed Sullivan used to say. My guest and only guest is Tammy Flanagan. She is a benefits expert par excellence, columnist for Government Executive, works with the National Institutes of Transition Planning, and is a frequent guest on their radio show here on Mondays at 10 a.m. So, Tammy, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Mike.
You
good
had
to be
some
here.
Beastly traffic today, too, didn't you?
It's always. It doesn't matter what time you leave.
Yeah.
You can leave 30 minutes early and you still get here at the same time.
Which is, I've heard many people give traffic as a reason for retiring. But we're going to mention that after this show, which ends at 11, Tammy and I are going to go into another control room and do an online chat. It'll be my first one. And Lauren Larson and Julia Ziegler and Tammy will be running it. I'm just going to stand around and look thoughtful and wise. But looking forward to that. We've got so many questions from people who wrote in to the chat line, and we'll get to some of them. But Tammy, I think with you, when on your tombstone they're going to chisel, when is the best day to die? And but the best date to retire, that's always one of your most popular columns of the year. And I sometimes mess it up and I say the best date, like there is one, but there are a number of best dates, aren't there?
Yeah, there can be. It just depends on what your goals are. And I think this all started, back in the early 90s when you and I talked about this, mm-hmm. this idea of strategizing a good date to retire. And there are some rules of thumb and some things that people can do to help them choose a date that's particularly good for them. And one of the things that a lot of people, seems like a very majority of people, like to do is maximize that lump sum payment for annual leave. And that's where the end of the year date has always become one of the best dates to retire. Because what people will do is they'll come into the new year, for example, coming into 2014, many employees, especially those who are near retirement, might have saved up enough leave to carry over the maximum, which for most employees is 240 hours. And then if they know they're going to retire in 2014, they may wait until the end of the leave year so that they can save up all of the leave that they earn and accrue this year and not take any. And so by the end of the year, they could have a balance in their account of over 440 hours. And a lot of people say, well, how can you have that if the carryover is 240? Well, that's true that you can only carry over 240, but if you retire before the end of the deadline, the end of the leave year, you can be paid for all of the leave you've accumulated this year plus what you carried over from last year. So it is possible to get a lump sum payment for that 448 hours of annual leave that you might have been able to save up.
And a lot of people, you can get it on the OPM website, but I think a lot of people aren't aware of how much money they make per hour.
Right.
And it's sizable in some cases, and you think, maybe I shouldn't have stood at the water cooler doing all that talking. They're paying me, you know, 30, 40, 50 bucks an hour. And
yeah, for most federal employees, it's more than the $10.10 an hour proposed minimum wage.
Absolutely. Right. Well, and in a situation like that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if I retire, say, at the end of the year or the first, second, or third, depending on the magic dates, and I get that annual leave, if there is a pay raise, then some of that annual leave, maybe most of it, will be paid at the higher rate. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, the way that payroll works that is that your lump sum leave payment has to be worth the same as what your salary would have been if you could have used the leave, which obviously all of that leave would have been used in the new leave year if you're leaving at the very end of the current leave year. Now, what happens is, because a lot of people have written to me already saying, well, you know, I retired January 11th and I didn't get the pay raise in my leave check. You might still be getting it because your payroll system may not have had the system updated to reflect the 1% pay increase at the time they paid out your annual leave. So you may find that next pay period, you'll see another deposit in your bank account for that extra 1%. So sometimes it's not paid at the same time they pay out your annual leave because that system hasn't been updated to reflect that new pay increase. But if you don't get it, contact your payroll office.
Well, there's a tax aspect to this too, because if you take your unused annual leave in the new year, the next year, then it won't be taxable in the current year when your income is higher. It'll be taxable in the year you receive it, which presumably your income will drop because you're retired as opposed to working.
Yeah, that's true for employees who don't go back to work after they retire. Mm-hmm. But then you have that added problem. If your idea of retirement is to retire and then get a second career or maybe a third career,
yeah,
you may actually have more income that year. So keep that in mind as well. But you're right that even though you left the government perhaps in 2013, your leave check for that year is paid in 2014. So you'll pay the tax on it. You'll report it as taxable income this year.
The other way to look at it is having to pay a lot of taxes is not that bad a problem.
That means you made a lot of money.
Made a lot of money,
That's
yeah.
right.
A couple of things here, but one, we got one, and here's Richard from NASA, and he's playing the family card here. Mm-hmm. He says, I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure. RTSP limits and IRA limits completely independent of each other, i.e., is it allowable to contribute $6,500, I am over age 50, to a Roth IRA and also contribute $23,000, that's $17,000 plus 550, to the TSP Roth? Is it allowable to contribute $6,500 to a Roth IRA and also contribute $23,000 to the TSP Roth? As my wife and I are retired, and I'm a government employee, our modified adjusted gross income is less than the $181,000 limit. And here's the clinker. He says his grandmother was a Flanagan from England via New Jersey.
So. Could be a relative of my husband, because they're from England as well.
Uh-huh.
Or actually Ireland.
Yeah, maybe that's what I thought. Yeah.
Who knows?
Most Flanagans, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a common name. But yeah, that's cool. The truth is you can contribute the maximum to an IRA, whether it's a Roth or a traditional. You can make those IRA contributions. And in addition to that, you can make your maximum TSP contributions, which, as he pointed out, for 2014 is $17,500 to your regular elective deferral limit to the thrift. And then if you are over age 50 or if you're turning age 50 this year, you can make the catch-up TSP contributions of $5,500. So, yeah, if you have enough money to save both in the thrift and additionally into an IRA, you can feel free to do that.
That's incredible. That is a very worthwhile question. Tammy, for our online discussion, which is coming up at 11 a.m., we got just a stack of questions here. I'm delighted, but I can't believe it. There were a couple here that I thought might take a look at. Here's one, and we get this all the time. The grass is always greener. You know, the other guy has it better. But there's this battle, if you will, in some federal offices between the older employees who are under the CSRS system, Civil Service Retirement System, and the newer employees, and they're not that new now, they're mid-1980s, who are under the Federal Employees Retirement System. So it's CSRS versus FERS. And one of the questions is, what are the major differences between the CRS program, the FERS program, and the CRS offset program, which is yet a very odd fish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a seminar a couple of weeks ago where I almost got into a big argument with a woman, because I sometimes, if I have a mixed audience where I have both CSRS and FERS employees in the class, I'll put a line down the middle of my flip chart and I'll say, you know, if you have 30 years under civil service, here's what you get. And if you have 30 years under FERS, you know, here's how that works. And at the end of the day, you know, the bottom line is about the same. Mm-hmm. And it really is. And she got mad at me. She goes, don't try to sugarcoat FERS for us. We know it's not a good mm-hmm. system, and we know we're inferior to CSRS. And so she was really angry that I tried to make them look similar. But the reality is, depending on how much service you have, depending on your salary, depending on how well you manage your TSP, you know, there's a lot of variables that will factor into how much your retirement's going to be, whether it's FERS or CSRS or private industry or whatever you happen to have for your retirement. And the thing to remember is that every retirement is going to be made up of three components. It's going to be, and maybe three if you're lucky. You may not only have one or two. But for many people, especially government employees, they have a pension, which is either going to be the civil service retirement, which was meant to stand alone.
Right.
That could be your retirement. That could be the only component. Or you can have the FERS retirement, which is one part of a three-part system. So you figure out, what is that pension worth? And that depends on how long you've been in the government, how much your salary is. It's a component of those two factors. Then you add to that the second component, which is your savings. You know, there's people who have saved $50,000, and there's some people who have saved $5 million. And, of course, depending on how much you've saved is going to determine how much income you can derive from that savings. So you've got, whether it's the thrift plan or IRAs you've been saving or other employer savings plans, you have that savings component. And then the third component is Social Security. Now, the CSRS employees haven't paid into it, but yet they can qualify if they've worked outside of their federal career. So even a CSRS employee could have a small Social Security benefit. But certainly a FERS employee has probably paid into Social Security their entire working lifetime. And so their Social Security benefit could represent anywhere from 15% replacement to as much as 50% replacement of their pre-retirement income. Depending on their salary, depending on their length of time they've paid in, there's a lot of factors that determine how much their Social Security is going to be. So the fact of the matter is, you know, it's hard to say that FERS and SERS, one's better, one's worse than the other. It just depends on how it's worked out for you, whether or not you've spent your entire career in federal service. But I could certainly make an argument that they're both equally good systems.
Yeah, and it really is pretty counterproductive, too, to spend your entire career wishing you had been born 2 years earlier or had joined the government two years earlier. The one thing that I would point out is that the Federal Employees Retirement System was designed by federal employees.
That's right.
People who are currently in the system. You and I knew them, Jamie Cowan, mm-hmm. who worked for Senator Ted Stevenson. Exactly.
Yep.
And the Congressional Research Service had major input into it. And they said, we can't go on with this current CSRS defined benefit program. It's taking up 30% of the budget right. or something of the federal employee budget, but we're going to have to get a substitute here, force people to help plan their own retirement. And when it was set up, I believe the Thrift Savings Plan was going to supply up an estimated 30% of their post-retirement income. In the 90s, when it was going gangbusters, it was going to supply as much as 50%, but that would be a good thing.
And there are some people today who that's true for. I met a guy not too long ago who retired, I guess, just last month. And he was a NASA employee out in California at one of the Air Force bases. And his TSP account has just passed the $1 million threshold. And he said, I just want people to know
can be done.
That it can be done. And I'm no different than anybody else. I'm not a high-level employee. I'm just, you know, whatever GS
level. I wanted to ask you about that.
Was.
We need to take a short break mm-hmm. here on federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan. She's a benefits expert with the National Institutes of Transition Planning and also a columnist for Government Executive and very well known in the federal community. And Tammy, you are a frequent guest on Bob Lyne's For Your Benefit show on Mondays at 10 a.m.
That's right.
Doing that a lot. This is a kind of a labor of love for you. You were at the FBI for a while, weren't you?
I was way back when, back in the 80s, 1980 to 1988. And that's I went through the FERS transition with them, and that's when I struck out on my own to be a trainer.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Well, and our number here, by the way, is 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080, if you want to give us a call. Tammy, we always come back with you to the best date to retire, best dates to retire. Specific one here is part of our online chat later on today. And he asks, what is the best date to retire? I think he said in July 2014. Mm-hmm. And you could modify this to make it June 2014 or
whatever.
March, yeah.
Yeah, there's some general rules because we had talked earlier about people who like to retire at the end of the year because they're maximizing their lump sum leave. But if you're not all about getting a big payout of your leave, any month can be a good month for you to retire. And if you, we'll take, for example, the month of July this year. Under FERS, if you're a FERS employee, you have to remember that no matter what day of the month you retire July 1st, you retire July 31st, your first retirement check is going to be for the month of August, and it's going to be dated September 1st. So with that in mind, you'd probably want to retire July 31st, so you could be paid your salary the whole month of July, and you would get your August check, and it would be paid September 1st. Now, if you're a CSRS employee, the only difference is you have this little grace period every month where you can retire the first, second, or third day of the month, and you would still get a retirement check for the rest of that month. So you could retire July 1st, 2nd, or 3rd, which is Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, and therefore get paid your salary for those 3 days and still get the remainder of the July retirement payment. So that might make sense. So you can get 3 more days at full salary. So that's what I would tell that person. You know, look at July 1st, 2nd, or 3rd. If you wanted to work that whole month of July, wait till the 31st, or even retire Friday, August 1st, because, you know, that's still within the first 3 days of the month of August. So what I would suggest at this point, since we're still a few months out, is to get two retirement estimates. You know, run one for July 3rd, maybe run another one for August 1st, and see how your years, months, and days come out. You know, see if you end up with 32 years, 9 months, and 29 days on July 3rd, and maybe you can get a whole another 2 months if you retire at the end of July. So I'd get those estimates to really fine-tune the date. Talk to your retirement counselor. They should be able to help you.
That's one where it does pay to nitpick, doesn't
it? Does.
It
does, sure, yeah. 2 months, that's 2/12 of 1% or 2/12 of 2% of your high three.
Okay. The $64,000 question for an awful lot of federal workers, and one of the things that when it happens, some people think the retirement tsunami will actually begin to take place, and that is this phased retirement. Can you tell us what the law says about phased retirement? And I gather, and this that was the subject of my column today, it's one of these, the devil's in the details. It sounds easy.
Yeah.
The House and Senate say, let people go into phased retirement, mentor their replacements, mm-hmm. and everybody's happy. But then how do you make that work?
Yeah, that's the devil's in the details, because the law actually passed in the summer of 2012. It was signed into law by the president. You know, we thought, okay, within a year, you know, we'll have people doing phased retirement. Well, you know, there's a lot of little details that have to be worked out as far as the TSP. You know, how will you be treated as a retiree or as a employee? Can you take withdrawals? Can you make contributions? So that has to be worked out. Then it comes to insurance. Are you going to pay your insurance out of your salary, out of your half retirement check? Or if you die in service during this phase time, is that going to be treated as a death of an employee or a death of a retiree? So there's that issue. If you owe money to the retirement fund, you'd have to pay that back before you go into phased retirement. So there has to be details of how that's going to be conveyed to the employee. If you're married, you know, what about spousal benefits when you go into phased retirement? Do you elect them now or do you elect them later? Your work schedule, is it going to be flexible or can it only be 50% versus 100%? And that has been decided that initially it's going to just be a 50% schedule. And then finally, the time limit. You know, will the agency let you do this for unlimited, mm-hmm. you know, for the next 20 years you could be a phased retiree, or is it going to be limited to 1 year, 5 years, whatever? So right now, that's being worked out. OPM is in this pondering stage where they're mm-hmm. considering all these what-if situations. What if the employee wants to do this? What if the agency asks us this? And so they have to come up with the answers to those questions before we actually implement it. So the last I've heard, it's definitely not going to be this spring. I think the earliest you'll see phased retirement become available would be July, and that's probably being overly optimistic. So I would say realistically, maybe the end of the year, and even as far as early 2015, I would think, if there's, you know, stumbling blocks yeah. as they start to introduce this, because there have to be forms implemented. There's going to have to be procedures set up. Agencies are going to have to be trained as to how to convey this to their employees. So it's just not seeming to come quickly as we had hoped.
It's so interesting in a situation like this. I, as an individual, I'm ready to retire. I like the phased thing. So I think here's the ideal thing. Let's tailor it for people who are 6 feet tall with, you know, with a mustache and that kind of thing. And they can't work that way. The Congress in generality says, let's end poverty. And then they hand a bill to the bureaucracy and say, get this done.
Go figure it out.
Yeah.
That's right.
And in this case, I didn't realize how many, I mean, you raised a lot of issues there. I didn't realize how many stopping points there were in this until the National Active and Retired Federal Employees showed me a letter that they had sent to OPM, and they making suggestions, and they raised points and issues I hadn't thought of, and they're major, and they're important to employees, they're important to the government, they're physically important as well. So 2015 would not be a long time for people, but it would not be unrealistic.
Right. So yeah, if you're not in a hurry to retire. And if you like the idea, and I think who this is really best suited for is someone who can afford to retire right now.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not ready. You know, they love what they do. They're still making an impact at their agency. So it would be great if I could just work 20 hours a week, and that way I could collect half of my retirement, half of my paycheck. So it's still more than I'd get if I had been retired. but it's less time involved in coming to work, and it's a manageable schedule. It's a nice way to ease into it rather than going cold turkey.
So right. Yeah, one of the things NARF raised the issue was, do you still get the employee contribution to your thrift savings plan if you continue in it? And just any number of things
lots
like
of
that.
Different questions. Yeah, and the TSP has addressed a lot of those, and the final answer from the thrift was you would be treated as an employee. So you would still get your matching contributions. You would still be able to contribute to the TSP. So they have looked at it. I believe they've answered most of the questions that came up regarding the thrift, but there's still a lot that OPM is still considering. And the agencies have to figure out, how is this going to benefit them?
Yeah.
You know, do we get to retain these employees that are very valuable to us, or is this, we're going to have to keep these employees who we'd really rather get rid of? So, how do you do that without being discriminatory? So.
Yeah, it's going to be like early retirement and buyouts. You don't just go into and say, boss, I want one of these by date certain. Mm-hmm. They will decide who gets it.
I guess, yeah. That's going to be interesting to see how that's going to become available to different employees and different agencies.
Yeah. The Federal Thrift Savings Plan, the 401k plan, a lot of people say it's the best one in the country. It's John Bogle, who set up the index fund in Vanguard, said he wished he could get in it. Alan Roth of CBS Money Watch said he'd like to find a way to get in the TSP. Because of the simplicity of it, because of the funds it offers, and because of the G fund, the never has a bad day, never has a good day G fund that's safe as the Rock of Gibraltar. That said, a lot of people, and we've had some people on our online chat here, some advanced questions, people who want to know the pros and cons of leaving your money in the TSP when you retire from government, or leave it, mm-hmm. or taking it with you, putting it in an IRA somewhere where you have a lot more, I guess, easier access to it.
Mm-hmm.
What are the pros and cons?
That's true. There are benefits to leaving money in the TSP, and there are benefits, like you said, to taking it out and putting it someplace else. And it doesn't mean you have to do all of one or the other. You can say, I'll take some of my money and move it to an IRA, and then leave some of it in the TSP where it enjoys the low administrative expenses, where I still have the G fund available to me, where I still have the simplicity of just those five investment options and the life cycle funds. So you'll see that a lot of people who leave federal service will take advantage of their one-time partial distribution, where they'll take some money out, maybe spend some of it, pay down some debt, or take a vacation, and then they'll take the rest of that partial distribution and reinvest it in an IRA where they have more diversification of investment options. And like you said, they can take out multiple partial withdrawals, because once you've taken that one partial distribution from the thrift, that's it. You can't come back next year and say, I want another $50,000. Next year, you would have to take a full distribution where you'd elect a monthly payment or an annuity or a second partial distribution, but it would have to be the rest of your money. So you only have that one option. So it doesn't make sense.
Don't want to be your bank or credit union, right?
Right. They don't. And I think that the problem would be the administrative expense.
Absolutely.
Of letting people come and go with taking money as they need it. That being said, the current expense ratio of all the TSP funds, the average of all the TSP expense ratio is 29 cents per thousand per year. Mm-hmm. And you compare that to the typical 401k plan in the private sector, the average administrative expense of that fund is $8.30 per thousand
Good
per
Lord.
Year.
Big
so
difference.
It's a huge
yeah.
difference.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
it's a big
you
difference.
You want to keep it that way. We need to take a short break here. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com.
That's a neat graphic.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tammy Flanagan. She is a benefits expert, very well known in the federal community, writes a column for Government Executive, and also works with the National Institutes of Transition Planning, and appears on the NITP show frequently here on Mondays at 11. Tammy, what is NITP? Give yourself a plug.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The National Institute of Transition Planning is a company that's sole purpose is training federal employees about their retirement. So we do seminars throughout the government, both here in D.C. and abroad and across the country, on both pre-retirement planning, mid-career planning, and new employee planning as well. And what we're finding is this shift and I'm hoping most agencies start to catch on to this, is that pre-retirement planning used to be 30 days before you yeah. walked out the door. That has to start now when you're first hired. You know, I did a seminar yesterday for the FDA, and the person who set it up, the head of that department, he said that I asked him, I said, what's the age range of who's coming to the class today? And he says, oh, it's anywhere from mid-20s to, you know, ready yeah. to walk out the door. And I was so happy to hear that, because he agreed that he wanted his new and younger employees to understand how their retirement works so they could plan to have a successful retirement. Because FERS is very much audience participation. You can't just sit back and work for 30 years and expect to have a nice retirement. You have to participate. So we like to see the young folks coming out to pre-retirement planning or mid-career, whatever you want to call it.
Well, you know, they're always talking about ways to improve morale and retain the best people and get bright young people. And one thing that's right under their nose, they being the government's nose, is starting early on to tell people about their benefits. Because, you know, a lot of people, you come out of high school or college, you get a government job, you're not thinking about retirement. You're not thinking about the thrift savings plan. Maybe you can't afford to get into it. But if you let people know what they have vis-a-vis what their colleagues in the private sector have, you know, a defined benefit pension plan indexed more or less to inflation with a 5% government match, in the thrift, that's unheard of.
And it all belongs to you. As soon as you put the money in,
right.
it's yours. So
that's
even
right.
if you did leave early, you take it with you.
It's a 5% tax-deferred pay raise. But if you let them know these things early on, you might keep them early. And I know I've been to a number of NITP seminars, and the thing that I find, in addition to having an expert up front with a chart or a green screen or whatever, but in addition to having that, it's the wisdom of the crowd. Mm-hmm. And somebody will ask a question that you maybe not only didn't have the nerve to ask, but you didn't think about.
Right.
And yet that sort of enriches the...
Yeah, there's always a good dynamic when you have 30 people in a room that have all different backgrounds
yeah.
and different questions. It's exciting to teach whenever
yeah.
you have that interaction.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that we have to figure out, how to do that with a webinar, you know, with
yeah.
with online training, because it's so, you know, solo focused. You don't have that energy of the crowd.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not sure there is a way, but here's a question for our online chat later on. But Marie says, how does Medicare fit into the federal employee health benefits program? It's a big concern of mine, as I am a year and a half from retirement. Medicare and the Part B and
yeah, I think the biggest problem for federal employees when it comes to Medicare is the fact that you don't have to enroll. In other words, if you carry your federal health benefit program into retirement, they'll cover you whether you choose to enroll in Medicare or not. They have to. They'd probably rather not, but mm-hmm. your FEHB plans can't drop you when you're 65. They'll still cover you. So it's your choice whether or not you choose to enroll in Medicare Part A, Part B, Part C, and Part D. And then there becomes the other issue, is what are these four
yeah.
parts of Medicare? You know, how do I possibly understand? Well, the original Medicare was A and B, the inpatient under Part A, the outpatient under Part B. And that's the two parts that most federal retirees will enroll in. Part A, of course, it's because you've paid the tax. And so that's free once you're 65. So when you pay the Medicare tax as an employee, you're qualifying for premium-free Medicare Part A, which is going to help when you go into the hospital to spend the night. Now, when you have that combination of FEHB and Medicare Part A and you go into the hospital, if you're retired, Medicare will pay the bulk of your hospitalization. Your federal health plan will pick up most, if not all, of the difference. So in many cases, when you have that combination as a retiree, you'll get a statement saying Medicare paid this and Blue Cross paid that, and you pay nothing. So it's really wise to enroll in Medicare Part A when you turn 65. And that's true whether you're still working or retired, but especially if you're retired. Part B is the big sticking point, because Part B has a premium. So when you enroll in Part B, the current premium is almost $105 a month. And if you're a wealthier retiree, you'll pay more than that, because it's means tested. Mm-hmm. So the higher your adjusted gross income, the higher the premium. So you have to justify paying that $105 or more dollars a month per person to make it worth it to you to have Part B in addition to FEHB. And many people argue that, well, Medicare Part B covers doctor visits and outpatient surgery and physical therapy, and so does my federal health plan. So why would I need duplicate coverage? Well, it's because when your federal health plan pays a secondary payer, in many cases, they'll waive your copay, your deductible, your coinsurance. So just like I said with Part A, you'll get a statement. It'll say Medicare paid 80% of that cardiologist visit, Blue Cross paid 20%, and you pay nothing other than that $105 mm-hmm. a month. And you're thinking, okay, well, if I schedule my social life around my doctor visits, it's worth having. But if I'm only going to the doctor once a year for a checkup, why would I need to pay that? And that's where the big dilemma comes in.
Tax question, and no reason you should know, but are your Medicare Part B premiums, are they tax deductible?
No.
They're not.
You pay those after tax.
Okay.
The premium is deducted from your Social Security check.
Right. Okay. The reason I ask, and I always use this example, my mother was a government retiree. She also worked in the private sector. So she had a relatively small civil service pension and Social Security, and I think that's it. But she got long-term care insurance through the government, but she got it. And she was as healthy as could be all of her life until the last couple of years. Then she got dementia and, you know, horrible, horrible thing. But because she had bought the maximum coverage, she had Medicare A and B, she had long-term care insurance, she had one of the good federal programs, our out-of-pocket expenses were minimal, and there was a dignity factor for her, too. She could go into a very upscale, nice nursing home.
She was cared for in the way she would have wanted to be.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is people are saying young people aren't signing up because they're healthy. Mm-hmm. But young people can step into the front of a bus as easily as anybody else.
Yeah, it could ruin you financially.
Yeah. Okay. And one of the young people is giving me the signal now. Got to take a short break. Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Tammy Flanagan, columnist for Government Executive Magazine, presenter with the National Institutes of Transition Planning, and you do your own radio show from time to time here on Mondays. And you and I are going to do an online chat, my first, coming up at 11 o'clock. So I hope people will sign up for that and get some answers. Tammy, during the break, we were talking about belt and suspenders and that kind of thing. And you made a really good point about the age of transition between life insurance and long-term care insurance.
Right.
And I know we've had long-term care experts on the show before, and you say, what's a good age to get it? And I think I got mine when I was in my early 50s, maybe even before. And that's really, many people would say that's too young. But again, I'm belt and suspenders. I could afford it. I'm glad I had it. I hope every penny of my premium is wasted. Hope I never cash in on it. But what do you tell people about long-term care versus life insurance?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't think it's really never too young to buy long-term care insurance if you can find the cash available to afford it, because it's something you're going to pay for every month the rest of your life, basically. So younger folks typically don't have that extra $100 a month or even $50 a month that they can set aside for that. So when it becomes an issue of affordability, you have to think about your life insurance needs, because for most people, we don't need life insurance the rest of our life, believe it or not. You know, most of us buy life insurance when we're younger, maybe when we bought a house or when we got married or when we started having a family. We thought, what if, you know, what if we die at 35? You know, who's going to raise these kids? Who's going to pay off the house? So I need a ton of life insurance. But we find that as we get older, number one, hopefully the kids grow up and become independent someday and don't come back. And then the house maybe gets paid off. And so our needs for that life insurance have changed by the time we're in our 40s, 50s, or 60s. And so if we don't need as much life insurance and we consider what we're paying for it, maybe we can cut back on the life insurance and save some money to put towards the cost of long-term care insurance. So in the industry, I've heard that actually has a name. It's called trading premiums.
Mm-hmm.
So you trade the premiums you spend on life insurance and turn them into long-term care insurance premiums, which now at this time in your life becomes more of an immediate need. You think, what if? You know, what if I got dementia like my mother or my father? You know, how would I pay for that, or how would I be cared for?
Well, and that too, both life insurance and long-term care insurance is really a gift to the people you leave behind.
That, to me, that's the most important reason to have it. It's not to protect your assets.
Right.
It's to protect your caregiver, because the number one person who's your caregiver is a family member.
Yeah.
So whether it's one of your children or your spouse who's going to be put in that role, give them a break. You know, say, here, I have $200 a day. You can hire at least one shift of someone to come in and help take care of me if I need it.
Absolutely. It really, really is the ultimate gift. Interesting question here from Carol. She says, my HR department tells me I can't designate my grandson for my survivor's benefit when I retire next year. While I do not claim him on my income tax, he has an insurable interest in me. Not married, I have no other survivor. But were I to marry, can the election change or have an addition?
Yeah. Whenever you retire under both civil service and FERS, you have to choose what kind of a retirement you want. And you have the choice, if you're married, to elect a maximum or a partial survivor benefit for your spouse. That's not free. It's going to be a reduction to your retirement of about 10% if you do the maximum. So it's like you're buying life insurance, so that if you die, part of your retirement continues to be paid to your spouse. Now, another election is no survivor benefit. So if I'm single, no one is really financially depending on me, I'm going to take my whole retirement, no reduction, and when I die, it dies with me. If I should later marry, I can elect a survivor benefit for a spouse that I get married to after I retire. You have the option to do that. Now, what this woman's asking about is another election on the form that says, I choose to provide an insurable interest survivor benefit for this person I'm naming. And in her case, she wants to name her grandson. Now, technically, she could do that. She could say, I'm going to name, you know, Johnny Smith. He's my insurable interest. And he's a close relative, so he would qualify. The reason why I would say it's probably not practical to do that is because when you name this person as your insurable interest, your retirement's going to get reduced, just like it does for a spouse. Only in this case, the reduction is based on your age difference. So if you're naming a grandchild who might be 30 or 35, 40 years younger than you, your retirement's going to be reduced by 40%. So if your retirement was $50,000 a year, it's going to be reduced by $20,000 a year to pay for that benefit. And all your grandson's going to get is 55% of what's left, the $30,000 that's left for the rest of his life. So if you're willing to pay that high premium, then I guess it's okay to do it. But I definitely think you should reconsider. It's not necessarily a practical election.
Better to open an account in a credit union, isn't it?
Yeah, make the grandson the beneficiary of your TSP account, yeah, or your life insurance, or buy a life insurance policy and name him as the beneficiary. That would probably be more cost effective than to do the insurable interest. Mm-hmm. That insurable interest is more for someone who's closer to you in age. Maybe you live with somebody, but you're not married, and you want to leave them like you would leave a spousal benefit, where it's only going to be a 10% reduction rather than 40%.
Well, you mentioned the spousal benefit, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've always thought that one of the things that's the government program is superior in so many ways is that if you have a spouse, you can elect a survivor benefit. If the spouse predeceases you, and this is where I may be off, then your benefit is made whole. Is
that's
that
right. You're
that,
right.
That doesn't happen in the private
right.
sector.
Right. Well, some private sector plans, but not all. And they yeah. call it a pop-up benefit. Uh-huh. We don't call it that in the government, yeah. but that's essentially what it does. So that if you elect that benefit and your retirement gets reduced by 10%, and then 15 years after you retire, let's say your spouse dies, mm-hmm. then you notify OPM that my spouse passed away last month. Here's the death certificate, and OPM will restore your annuity back to the unreduced amount. Now, what you've paid for the last 15 years, of course, was life insurance you had while you needed it. But from that point forward, you'll get your full annuity back.
And if you're single or widowed or what have you and go into retirement, and you marry in retirement, you can still cover the...
You can, yeah. In the regulations, I always laugh about this because the way it's written, it says, if an annuitant acquires a spouse
yes.
after retirement, like you go out yeah. and acquire a spouse yeah. on the street. But if you get married after retirement, you'll have, and here's the other funny part, you have a two-year test drive. So they give you 2 years from the date of marriage to determine if that new spouse is worthy of this benefit, because they'll let you wait till the end of the 2 years to actually make the election. So make sure it's going to work out. Make sure you don't get divorced.
That gives you some power over him or her, too.
Yeah, and the nice thing is your choice. You know, if you're retired and married at the time of retirement, you have to elect it. Your spouse is the only one who can waive it. But if you marry after retirement, you can decide if they're worthy of that benefit.
I've once had a woman that I knew slightly in a gym ask me if I knew any older established men, and I of course thought she was talking about me, but she wanted a government worker with Blue Cross standard.
Absolutely.
I mean, only in Washington would she have it down pat, but that was her ideal man.
I think that should go on the top of the Match.com app.
Yeah.
Survivor
yeah.
benefits and insurance.
Kim, we've got about a minute left. Is there anything you want to bring up, or maybe we'll get prep people for our online chat?
Yeah, looking at the questions that came in during, we asked for questions to come in ahead of time for the online chat. And I just have to say that the readers and listeners of this show are really asking very good questions. They're to the point and specific, but they're also general, that they apply to a lot of people. So I do hope that people will get some benefit out of this, because I think it's a great service that you've decided to do today.
Yeah, I just, when I first saw it, I saw the questions and some of your partial answers, I said, you have just written the next 22 columns for me, so thank you for that.
There we go.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tammy, and thank you, everybody. We're going to be moving over to our other studios to do our online chat. Join us if you can. Otherwise, we'll see you here next Wednesday at 10 a.m. And remember, we're archived on our homepage, so you can listen anytime. And this particular show would be a good one to refer for friends. So see you next Wednesday. Stay safe.